studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Wednesday, July 29th, 2015. Congress is working on overhauling public education more dramatically than in well over a decade. We'll turn to education historian Diane Ravitch about the changes being proposed and how they could affect students and teachers. And journalist Roberto Lovato has just published a major expose about Leopoldo Lopez, the new leader of the Venezuelan opposition. He'll join us to explain Lopez's links to the U.S. establishment and more. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Courtney Morris. She's an assistant professor of African American and Women's Studies at Penn State University. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, Sonali.
Afghan and Pakistani sources are claiming that the mysterious leader of the Afghan Taliban, Mullah Muhammad Omar, is dead. Mullah Omar has not been seen in public for well over a decade, and rumors of his death have appeared several times over the years. Afghan government officials made the claims this morning and say they are investigating the fact that the elusive Taliban commander may have died 2 years ago. As of this morning, there has been no statement from the Taliban confirming or denying the news of his death. According to Pakistani media, Omar's son, Mullah Muhammad Yaqub, has been jockeying for leadership of the organization. The Taliban was about to begin a second round of peace talks in Islamabad with Afghan government officials aimed at ending the violent 13-year-long conflict. In mid-July, AFP reported that Mullah Omar lauded the peace talks through the Taliban's official website, saying, quote, "All mujahideen and countrymen should be confident that in this process, I will unwaveringly defend our legal rights and viewpoints everywhere." Well, Courtney, it's not possible to say whether or not he is alive, of course, but if his death is confirmed, could it derail these peace talks?
Well, certainly. I mean, there is a fairly intense power struggle unfolding in the Taliban right now between those members of the organization who are prepared to enter into peace talks with the government and hardliners in the group who still continue to feel very strongly that fighting against the government should continue until all foreigners have been expelled from Afghanistan. So, you know, hardliners in the group have also been getting a bit of a kind of ideological boost with the presence of a local chapter of the self-proclaimed Islamic State, which recently emerged in the country. And there is a real fear among both group individuals inside of the group, as well as experts outside who are watching these developments very closely, that hardliners who are frustrated by the Taliban's decision to engage in peace talks with the government, that those hardliners may in fact switch their allegiance to ISIS and create further conflict, deepen the conflict in the country already. So this really seems to be a misinformation campaign designed specifically to destabilize the peace talks. I think the real question is who's behind it. And who's really driving this misinformation campaign.
Here in the U.S., news of another police killing of an unarmed African-American man is making headlines. On July 19th, Samuel DeBose was shot in the head by a white University of Cincinnati police officer, Ray Tenzing, who pulled him over for not having a front license plate. The prosecutor in the case has refused to release the body camera worn by Tenzing, saying, quote, "It is not good," and implying that it disputes Tenzing's claims of self-defense. The city is apparently bracing itself for riots in the event of the video's release. DuBose's funeral took place yesterday. Meanwhile, in the Texas police custody death of Sandra Bland, Waller County prison officials have released a new video showing Bland getting her mugshot photo taken. They were responding to rumors that Bland may have died before she entered the prison. Officials say the prison is receiving death threats. Courtney, how important is it for us to demand the release of each and every single video over a contentious arrest or police killing?
I guess it could seem a bit tedious having to demand this footage over and over and over again, but I think it's going to remain critical to do so until transparency and accountability become standard operating procedure for police departments. I think what we're seeing in both the Samuel DeBose case and the Sandra Bland case is that the public really does not trust the police, particularly communities of color do not trust the police, do not take them for their word. And the truth of the matter, as far as I can tell, is that the police really have not given those communities any reason to do so. And so I think that if the police are serious about rebuilding the broken relationship between those between policing institutions and the communities that they are paid to serve, transparency is going to be the or needs to be the order of the day, and sharing that footage is an important step in repairing the rift between police and those communities.
And finally, the political circus around Donald Trump's candidacy for the presidency continues. Because his poll numbers among potential Republican voters are so high, news media are obligated to cover the businessman turned politician. Now, Politico is reporting that the billionaire Koch brothers, who have financed most major Republican candidates, are freezing Trump out. According to the Politico report, the network of Koch-backed policy and political outfits is using behind-the-scenes influence to challenge Trump more forcefully than the Republican Party establishment by limiting his access to the support and data that would help him translate his lead in the polls into a sustainable White House campaign. Meanwhile, Trump has said he would invite Sarah Palin into his cabinet if he were to be elected president. Well, Courtney, Newsweek published an op-ed saying that the Republicans brought the Trump circus on themselves. Do you agree?
I absolutely agree. You know, I mean, I think Donald Trump is the GOP's worst nightmare. He's a wildcat candidate who has the financial resources to back his own campaign, fund his own campaign, and cannot be controlled by either the party or their corporate funders. And, you know, I think that the Newsweek article absolutely hits it on the head. The GOP has no one to blame for the rise of Donald Trump but themselves. You know, over the last 40 years, the GOP has really been instrumental in creating the kind of culture of political mudslinging and rhetorical mean-spiritedness that has completely diminished our sort of political process here in the United States. And so it's interesting to see that the GOP's base really responds to this style of politics, which is precisely why Donald Trump is proving to be so popular among them. So, you know, again, the GOP has no one else but themselves to blame for Donald Trump's popularity.
Courtney, thanks as always for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week. Courtney Morris is an assistant professor of African American and Women's Studies at Penn State University. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The GOP-dominated House and Senate are currently overhauling public education in a manner that could have a far-reaching impact. The House passed a version of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act that would rewrite many aspects of the bill, which was reincarnated under the George W. Bush administration as the No Child Left Behind Act. The House bill, which narrowly passed in early July, enables what conservatives like to call school choice, but also includes a mechanism for parents to opt their children out of standardized tests. The Senate version of the bill diverges from the House version significantly, and as a result of a compromise with Democrats, it will have to be reconciled with the House version in a conference committee before President Obama could sign it into law. But how much attention do lawmakers pay to what actually happens in public schools when they craft such bills? Joining me to discuss what's at stake in the education bill is Diane Ravitch. She is an education historian and author of The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. Her latest bestseller is called Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Welcome to Uprising, Diane.
It's wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Well, how important is this overhaul? It hasn't received very much news attention. I understand this is essentially the most dramatic change to the education bill since No Child Left Behind, but that was 14 years ago?
Right. Correct. No Child Left Behind was supposed to have been rewritten in 2007, but it created a dilemma. Congress literally didn't know how to get out of this testing conundrum that they're in, because No Child Left Behind is actually a rewrite of something called the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965. And that act was passed as part of Lyndon B. Johnson's War on Poverty. Hold on, I just have to
sure.
take this phone off the hook. ESEA was part of the War on Poverty. Its purpose was to send money to schools that had children in poverty. Over the years, especially in, starting in the Clinton administration, the idea became popular, well, maybe we shouldn't send the money out unless we know that the kids are actually getting higher test scores. George W. Bush pushed this law to another level altogether, turning into a law for testing and accountability and for punishing teachers, punishing principals, and closing schools if the test scores didn't go up. So we have a law that totally evolved from what was supposed to be one for equity for poor kids and resources for poor kids into a law that punishes poor kids and closes their schools if they don't get higher test scores. So once No Child Left Behind became law, it became a kind of a mandate that every child every year must be tested. And no senator, no congressman really had the nerve to stand up and say, this is not producing better schools, it's just enriching the testing industry. And so finally, this year, Congress is prepared to move on it. But I think the problem is we have a Congress where both houses are controlled by Republicans. But frankly, even the Republicans are sick of all the micromanagement from Washington, D.C. And so they're backing away a little bit. They're saying you have to test every year, which no other nation, by the way, does. You must test every year, but it's up to the state to decide whether to punish the teachers in the schools, not the federal government.
Now, and just to back up a little bit, under the Obama administration, the sort of testing regimen was made even more concrete through the Race to the Top initiative, right? But that was sort of on top of the No Child Left Behind bill, a separate initiative?
Right. It actually was taking the worst aspects of No Child Left Behind and doubling down on them. Secretary Duncan, and I assume President Obama, who appointed him, believe that everything should be tested, that every child should be tested, and that teachers should be evaluated based on the test scores of their students. This is a really bad idea. It doesn't work anywhere. Hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, have been spent recalibrating evaluation systems, and yet there's not a single district in America that will say, this has worked. It has not worked. In fact, what's happened since the recalibration of the evaluation systems is that in state after state, somewhere between 96 and 98% of the teachers are found to be either effective or highly effective. So these systems don't work, but it has created pressure for high-stakes testing. It's created even more pressure than there was under No Child Left Behind, and No Child Left Behind is still the law of the land.
So let's talk about the two versions of the bill. The House passed a version of the bill that agrees with the Senate version on some aspects but diverges on other aspects. The House version of the bill, which is called the Student Success Act, it was essentially done without very much Republican support. And what can you explain the choice aspect of this bill? Of course, and Republicans like to use the word choice a lot, but essentially this would allow public school students to attend the school of their choice, so take the dollars that are supposed to fund their education to any school, and that, you know, if that went on long enough, essentially you'd have schools that got lots of money and then schools in poor neighborhood that got very little money?
Well, actually, you made a misstatement. Mm-hmm. It was passed in the House with very little Democratic support.
Oh, right, right, right.
The Democrats are the minority party, mm-hmm. and the Democrats were not going to support something that said, strap a backpack full of cash on every child's back. Because what the House bill really is about is vouchers. And this has been the goal of a very far right wing, really extremist in the conservative, in the Republican Party, wanting to have a full choice so that kids can choose to homeschool and be paid by the government. Kids can go anywhere and say the money will follow them. Democrats have had some lingering attachment to the public school system, although Democrats fully supported the charter aspects of the Senate bill. And there's a lot of new money and new authorizations for charter schools in the Senate bill, but the voucher idea was voted down in the Senate. So when they go to conference, you'll have the Senate bill, which is really a much better bill, a more moderate bill, conference with a very radical right-wing bill coming from the House of Representatives.
So there's the charter school aspect of these education bills. There is the testing aspect of it, which, as you mentioned, they're going to pull back from just a little bit, leave it more up to the states. Then there's a teacher evaluation bit of these bills. And let's talk about that, because teacher evaluation, teacher pay, et cetera, is being linked to test scores under the current version of the bill. This is something teachers' unions have fought against. What is the current status in the new bills that were just voted in, and do the House and Senate versions agree?
Well, the Senate version is very clear that there will be no federal mandate requiring states to link teacher evaluation and student test scores. This, by the way, was, the signature policy of Arne Duncan as Secretary of Education. Was his belief that you could, that districts could use test scores to evaluate teachers. And it has been a national failure that's cost many hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. In the Senate bill, it says this is a decision left to the states. Now, for people who are have been, like me, very frustrated by, first of all, Arne Duncan's very active role in imposing policies of privatization, and also of evaluating teachers by test scores. The Senate bill is a big improvement because it says the federal government will not get involved in this. It'll be left to the states. Some people say, well, this is going to be hard. Now we're going to have 50 fights. But I do think that the people who are opposed to this misuse and overuse of standardized testing will have more influence at the state level than they have at the congressional level, because frankly, there is very little way to influence Congress. Most members of Congress don't pay much attention to education, don't have much contact with teachers, have no idea how things are working out in the classroom, and they only listen to their ideological campmates. So I would say the Senate bill is a big improvement. I'm not sure what the House bill says about teacher evaluation, but I think that in both cases, both sides of the House and Senate, because they are Republican, they want to see a reduction of the federal role in education. In the past, Democrats have fought against this because states' rights have never been a good thing for equity and civil rights. But Arne Duncan so overplayed his hand in forcing through things that he believed in, like teacher evaluation tied to test scores, and like charter, more and more charter schools, which caused intensified segregation, that even the Democrats are willing to put in all of these limits on the federal role. So it's a very complicated situation because you have many people on the left saying that they actually support the Senate bill. It's going to be very interesting to find out what comes out of that conference committee, because there was a vote taken, and it was a very crucial vote on the Senate side about whether to pass something called the Murphy-Booker Amendment. The Murphy-Booker Amendment was voted for by every single Democrat, and it would have retained all the punishments of NCLB. So the politics are very confusing because you have the Democrats now basically hanging on to the George W. Bush sanctions and punishments. And every Republican, except I think there may have been one or two that didn't go along with it, but it was the Murphy-Booker Amendment was voted down. Because the Republicans didn't want the federal government to be punishing and closing schools. They thought that was overreach. I think they're right, because if we really want to improve schools, we have to recognize the root causes of low academic performance, and the most important root cause is poverty. Now, will the states recognize that? I don't know. Has the federal government for the last 15 years recognized it? Not at all. Federal government has, if anything, treated testing as the answer to poverty, and it's not. It's a really illogical response.
Now, in the House version of the bill, I understand there is an amendment that was passed that would allow students to skip standardized testing, which seems to be one of the few good things about that version of the bill. Have you heard about this?
Yes. The House bill supports the idea of parents have the right to opt their children out of the test. And the tests today are aligned with the Common Core. So there's a tremendous uprising against them. And there are many parents who have made this decision saying, if the tests are not valid, if they're not reliable, if they're going to tell me that my child has failed even before he's taken the test. I mean, what's happened in every state has been that the passing rates have dropped precipitously because the tests are anywhere from 1 to 2 grade levels above where the kids are. The Senate, on the other hand, did not include an opt-out provision, and they said that Senator Lamar Alexander, who was the chairman of the committee, said that he didn't want the federal government to mandate that states should allow opt-outs, that that should be a state decision. I mean, that's somewhat contradictory because, on the one hand, the federal government mandates annual testing, but will not mandate the parents' right to not take the test. They're leaving that up to the states. Now, you have to understand, there is no high-performing nation in the world that has annual testing. The other nations that we think of, the ones that get do very well on the international test, like Japan and Korea, South Korea, and Finland, Canada, those countries give a test usually at the end of sixth grade. In Canada, it's in third grade and in sixth grade. And in Finland, they have no standardized testing at all. So we somehow believe that we can't produce equity without testing. And there's no evidence that the testing produces equity. What it does is that it produces failure, and it forces the bell, all of the kids into the bell curve, and the bell curve never closes.
Diane Ravitch, you recently wrote about the suicide of a New York City principal named Janine Worrell Breeden, who jumped in front of a train and killed herself. She had been facing accusations of changing test scores on Common Core exams. What does this regimen of testing do, not just to the students, but also the teachers and the principals involved?
Well, on my blog, I hear from teachers and principals every day, and they're sick of all of this because they feel that the regime of high-stakes testing has, they're now being required to teach scripted lessons in many districts and states, and they feel that it's destroying their professional autonomy. It's taking away from them their ability to exercise judgment about what children need. And many are simply leaving the profession. This principal was accused of cheating, of filling in the answer. She said that, apparently she said that many of the students were unable to finish the test. And she had only third graders taking the test. It's a K through three or pre-K through three school. And so her children for the first time were taking the test. And according to the charges against her, she had finished the test for them because she didn't want to have a high failure rate. She didn't want them to be labeled as failures. And then when she was reported, she jumped in front of a subway train and killed herself. I mean, this is so awful. You know, there was a suicide a few years ago in Los Angeles,
yeah,
where a teacher, Rigoberto Ruelas, threw himself off a bridge after the test scores were published, and he was called an ineffective teacher. He apparently, from everything I've read about him, was a very effective teacher teaching in a tough school. And he was crushed by this judgment that was published by the Los Angeles Times. So I think that we've gone overboard with the standardized testing. The only ones that benefit, not the teachers, not the children, but the testing companies. And Pearson and McGraw-Hill have been cleaning up with this explosion of testing that's taken place since the passage of No Child Left Behind.
And speaking of standardized testing at the higher education level, George Washington University made news this week by joining a growing number of colleges and universities that are allowing students who apply to be students to opt out of submitting their SAT scores. And I'm wondering how important that is. I mean, this is, of course, we're talking about the public the higher education level rather than K through 12. But still, is this part of this growing sentiment that standardized tests are just not effective at measuring student success?
You know, what the research shows, and even the testing companies acknowledge this, is that the SAT and the ACT are less successful at predicting success in college for a student than their four-year grade point average. So you're putting a one-day snapshot of student performance, which may or may not show their skills and knowledge, versus 4 years of their persistence and work. And given the fact that you can learn more from their four-year grade point average, There are now about 800 colleges that have said, we don't require an SAT or an ACT test. If you want to take them and send your scores in, you can, but we don't care if you do or not. So that has allowed many students who want to apply to really some of the best colleges in the country have said this. So I think that's another point against standardized testing. You know, you remind me that in Florida, they've just passed a law saying that they'll pay a bonus to new teachers of $10,000 based on their SAT scores and ACT scores, which is totally stupid because this is a test that they take as juniors or seniors in high school. And yet 5 years later, they're going to be given a bonus if they enter teaching. As a result of this law, there will be brand new teachers making more money than people who've been teaching for 10 or 15 years.
Wow. Finally, Diane Ravitch, we have a very, very long drawn out presidential campaign heading into next year's elections. And Arnie Duncan, as you said, really should be seen as a reflection of the man who appointed him, which is President Obama. What do you make of the what most people are, you know, imagining would be the likely Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton, and her position on education? She has had a long political history leading into this campaign. Are you do you have any sense that Clinton may appoint somebody better than Duncan?
Well, I would say that the choice is going to come down to probably Hillary Clinton and one of the 17 Republican candidates. And I would say that whoever she chooses will be better than anyone chosen by those 17 people. even Jeb Bush, who poses as a moderate, is one of the most radical right-wing governors in the country when it comes to education. Scott Walker is even to the right of Jeb Bush. You know, what Donald Trump will do, I haven't heard. I haven't seen his education platform.
Oh boy.
But I have no doubt that Hillary Clinton would be responsible in choosing a secretary. And I think, and I hope, she would learn from the mistakes that Duncan and Obama have made. And she has not yet said anything much about education other than a speech that she gave to the American Federation of Teachers, in which she basically spoke in platitudes. But I hope to have the opportunity in the next few months to have some time with her and learn in more depth whether she understands the dire threat to a public education today. And public education is being privatized at a dramatic clip. We are losing public schools. For example, in Los Angeles, Los Angeles has more students in charter schools than any city in the country. These are schools that are lightly audited, unsupervised by the state in terms of the use of public dollars, and they're privately managed. That's privatization. And that movement is creating a dual school system. So we are, in effect, reverting back to the days of having a dual school system, which is what we had before the Brown versus Board decision of 1954. Then it was based on race. Today, it's based on other factors. Is this student a good fit? Are they likely to have high test scores? Are they likely to be less expensive to educate? I mean, charter schools have a record of A, being more segregated, even in highly segregated districts. They also tend to avoid kids with severe disabilities. And there are many charters across the country that have very few students who are English language learners. So I think that the privatization is occurring at a rapid pace. And the other thing that's happening is the commercialization of public education money. There are now equity investors who meet regularly to talk about how to make money in the public education sector. They see this as a huge pot of public money that has been thus far untapped by the markets. And they are busily figuring out ways how to tap in through consultants and software and hardware. And frankly, the Common Core standards have been a bonanza for the entrepreneurs because now everything changes.
Right.
And this creates opportunities to say, my product is Common Core aligned. You must buy my product.
Right. Well, Diane, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your blog from our website later today, dianeravitch.net. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to talk to you again.
My guest is Diane Ravitch. She is an education historian, and her latest best-selling book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar.